Your cues from the music, you would know that that is a very popular tune composed in the spirit of what it is we're going to start the program off today with. It is called Haitian Fight Song. And we just heard from I'm trying to juggle a whole bunch of things because my technical prowess is failing me today, but we'll get it together. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we start the program today by following up on a prediction that we made about Haiti, where the Prime Minister of Haiti has resigned, and he did so on Saturday, and causing now a new layer of anxiety in Haiti. To tell us what's going on in Haiti and what happened in Haiti on Saturday is our very friendly Kim Ives, who is the editor of the English edition of Haiti Liberté, and who has been covering Haiti and matters related to Haiti for right here on Lead Stories for quite some time. And today he also would follow up on a story he has been covering about the difficulties that Haitians continue to face in Central and South America as they try to make their way back home. Kim, great to have you with us again, once again.
Well, great to be back with you, Eutrice. And yes, we successfully predicted the future last time, didn't we?
Yes, we did. We knew that this rebellion had to have caused a major consequence, and it did. So tell us what happened on Saturday.
Well, on Saturday, the parliament, which is just about as unpopular as the executive, summoned Haitian Prime Minister, then Haitian Prime Minister Jacques-Guy Lafontaine, to a no-confidence vote at the parliament as the process began with a number of deputies basically denouncing him and saying that he was ineffective and was a disaster. And then one of them called for a no-confidence vote. And at that point, the leader of the majority bloc of the parliament, which is basically in line with the government and its allies, I said, okay, let's have a 10-minute recess. So they recessed. Then they all came back after the 10-minute recess, and Lafontaine took the microphone and said, well, I've already resigned. I've handed in my resignation. Why he didn't say that at the beginning of the process is unclear. But basically, he stole from the deputies the satisfaction of giving him a no-confidence vote. And, of course, everybody was very upset that they couldn't go on denouncing him because he was already out. So, essentially, just to review for the listeners, the Haitian executive works with the head of state, the president, that is, being elected every 5 years, and he appoints a prime minister who the parliament has to approve. Historically, usually they don't approve the prime minister nominee right away. This time they did because they're all basically of the same political family. But the long and short of it is the president, Jovenel Moïse, is very unlikely to be able to survive despite sacrificing the prime minister, as has been the case. This, again, as I think we mentioned last time, happened in 2014 when then Haitian President Michel Martelly faced a similar uprising, and he sacrificed his prime minister, Laurent Lamothe. The only thing that saved Martelly from also being ousted was the fact that the Lavalas family party intervened at the time and said, oh, no, we should let Martelly finish out his term. Loyalty that many Haitians weren't very happy about in the end, observance of protocol that they weren't happy with. I don't think that's going to happen again. At first, I don't think the Lavalas family is going to come forward and defend Jovenel. And, two, I think the people are really fed up now after basically 7 years since 2011 of PHTK, that's the Parti Haïtien Tête Calée, the Haitian bald-headed party's rule, which has been one just of corruption, of waste, of double talk, of bluff, as the Haitians call it, and of subservience to neoliberal dictates, such as the slashing of the subsidy on fuel to raise fuel prices in Haiti so that people can't survive. Already, the minimum wage in Haiti is $5 a day, and people are demanding $15 a day as minimum, $15 a day, not very excessive if you look here in the States. We're looking for $15 an hour. So at this point, I think the rebellion is going to continue. At the same time that Lafontaine was resigning, there was a demonstration winding through Port-au-Prince, which had been preceded by basically a giant town hall meeting of all the opposition leaders who have been not very united, have basically been at each other's throats. But they had a show of unity, and had one of them in particular, and a number of others seconded it, was proposing that they get, or said that they were going to give Jovenel only 21 days to get out of town, to resign basically and step down. The solution that they're proposing is what's called the Council of State. This took place actually about 30 years ago with the ouster of then dictator Prosper Avril. He left power, and they took the head of the Supreme Court, and that's what they're talking about doing again, taking the head of the Supreme Court, putting that Supreme Court justice in the interim president's post, and then having a Council of State, which will then basically act as a ruling body that would be drawn from different sectors of the population, peasants, students, workers, et cetera, but business community also would be represented, supposedly. That was how the election of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, the first democratic free election Haiti ever had in 1990, came about. This is basically the game plan that's a little incoherent right now. It's still sort of taking shape as people come together. I was on a radio show yesterday where one of the principal leaders, former Senator Moïse Jean-Charles, the head of the Petit Dessalines party, the Dessalines Children's Party, which is a breakaway from the Lavalas family, was laying out this scenario of the Council of State. And a Supreme Court justice, which had been proposed again back in 2013 and 14 as a solution to getting Martelly out. So, of course, the U.S. and Canada and France, the traditional imperialist overseers of Haiti, are going to object and, you know, push back. So I think we're going to see, as we were saying last time, quite a few months of turmoil and class struggle as the masses of Haiti try to wrest back the government of Haiti, which was more or less delivered into the hands of neo-devaluists by Clinton and Barack Obama back in 2011. Now they're trying to get it back in the people's hands. So there's the summary.
Well, there is that's the internal stuff. But how are countries outside of Haiti reacting? And what indications are they giving, other than, of course, their concern and this and that? But are there any indications that countries outside of Haiti are giving any kind of support to what is going on?
Well, you have in Haiti what is called the core group. It changes its name. It used to be called the Friends of Haiti. It's been called different names over time. Right now it's called the core group. And, of course, the real core of the core group is the U.S., France, and Canada, as I said. But, you know, they throw in a couple of other countries for decoration, Spain, Brazil, a few others. But the essence is that they are more or less the one that wags the finger, the organization that wags, the first organization to wag their fingers at the Haitian people and the Haitian government when there's an uprising like this. And most recently, last week, they said it's very important that the Haitians respect constitutional order. You know, that means don't overthrow Jovenel Moïse. Let him stay in power. And they called on the national authorities to engage in deep and inclusive dialogue with all the other key actors of the country so as to restore calm, promote social cohesion, and assure the security of people and property. Well, this is basically not going to happen. The Haitian people are not going to be obedient anymore, and they've made up their mind. I think Jovenel Moïse will eventually have to step down. Now, at the same time, you can be sure that this same core group, while calling for Haitians to respect constitutional order, are preparing their own government to supplant Jovenel. Back in 1986, 32 years ago, when Jean-Claude Duvalier was ousted by an uprising of this nature, they rolled out the day after he got on a plane with all his Maseratis and all his wife's furs to go to the Gold Coast of France, they rolled out a military junta, the head of which just died 2 weeks ago, maybe symbolically, Henri Namphy, General Henri Namphy. And very quickly, the people saw that this was devaluerism without devalier. It was the way the U.S. Was trying to preserve the repressive and exploitative status quo of Haiti. And there ensued 4 years of very pitched battle between the Haitian masses and this ruling group of generals, Henri Namphy, Williams Fagala, Prosper Avril, Cineas. They had a number of others who have remained. And in the background of the political scene, I should say, over the past decades. But so right now, I'm sure the U.S. in particular and its allies are trying to see how, what are we going to do if Jovenel goes? And constitutionally, it's supposed to be the head of the Supreme Court, who I should be ready with who that is right now. But yesterday in the radio show we did with Moïse Jean-Charles, he said it would not be the Chief Justice. It would be one of the justices, but not the Chief Justice. So the judiciary is pretty rotten, too. They've been pretty much appointed and aligned with the PHTK group, a little bit like Trump is doing with the Supreme Court here in the States and with all the federal judges putting in great reactionaries. So whatever sort of opposition slash popular slash democratic Council of State comes into play, they're definitely going to have to be picking over this array of rather lacking judges that make up the Haitian judiciary, which is famously ineffective and unjust. So we'll see. It's going to be a period of a lot of struggle, a lot of turmoil, a lot of chaos, and that's how revolutions are. So I think we may be on the verge. Now, will they be able to somehow shore up Jovenel? I don't think it's, we probably shouldn't break out the crystal ball, but since we had one lucky prediction, let's hope we can have another. But, I don't think it'll be more than a few months that he could stay in power, given the depth of the national dismay with him, unless there is a real massacre, a real reign of terror, a real bloodbath. But in Haiti, usually that doesn't work.
Well, the situation there remains ever fluid. And at some point, it will settle itself. And you get a very clear picture of what is the road ahead. I want to ask about the story that you've been following, which is the plight of hundreds of Haitians outside of Haiti who, in the midst of all the turmoil, within Haiti, have been trying to get back to Haiti in the midst of a duplicate program being followed in Central and South America, where they had gone as migrants, and now are reversing or making it difficult for Haitians who had gone there to work and to live to remain there. So they're trying to get back to Haiti, but they're encountering enormous impediments. Could you talk about what is happening with the Haitians from Central and South America trying to make their way back home?
Yeah, well, in Haitian Creole, you have the proverb, sauter la rivière, tomber dans la mer, run from the river and end up in the ocean. It's kind of out of the frying pan into the fire, a proverb. But many left Haiti over this past decade, really, but it has accelerated a lot under Jovenel Moise. First to Brazil, which at that point was supposedly a rising power. Since then, and since the political coups we've seen carried out by Washington there against Dilma and Lula and the putting in place of another mafia in the form of President Temer, and now they have another Trump in the wings coming. The Brazilian economy is in a total meltdown. So tens of thousands of Haitians who had gone there, sometimes traversing the Amazonian jungles to get there, have fled. Many in recent weeks and months have gone to Chile, but Chile now has their own version of Trump in power there, who said, you know, I'm going to get out and stop all these immigrants from coming and get them out, and has made their life hard, even though there are quite a few Haitians working there still, and in a few other countries, Ecuador, here in Colombia as well. But essentially, most are seeing that, you know, the only place they can really get refuge or really trying to head is to get into the U.S. somehow, or had been heading up through Latin America, first through South America, then up through Central America. Yes, many do want to end up going home, but not right now. The Pan-American Highway runs up the spine of Central America, as many may know. But when it gets to Colombia, in particular the town of Turbo, it stops. And there is no road between Colombia and Panama, the first nation of Central America. There is just a big jungle in there called the Darien Gap. And what happens is a lot of Haitians get to Turbo, then they have to take a boat, often very perilous. Some have sunk and people have drowned and died, getting just across that little bay from Turbo over to the shore where there's a town called Capargana, a very small town. And this part of Colombia is very remote. There are no roads. There's, you know, practically no electricity. There's it's a really wild west out there. And so they get to Capargana, and then they have to pay thousands to get through the jungle. It's a trek, 2 days to the border, and then 5 days to get from the Panamanian-Colombian border to civilization, as I understand it. And they're often taken by coyotes who are unscrupulous or downright treacherous, and have their baggage stolen or are robbed or killed sometimes. So it's a very difficult part of the trek to get up to the U.S. border, where many are still stuck in Tijuana or other border towns with the U.S. You know, this is an area we really want to, at Haiti Liberté, want to look into. It's an area where you can just parachute into. You need to really know what you're, because it is an area where you can easily end up losing your wallet, your bag, or even your life. So in any case, that is the drama going on here in the continent. And there are literally thousands and thousands of Haitians. I mean, you find Haitians everywhere throughout the Caribbean. But, you know, particularly in the past years, since the UN military occupation began in 2004, the number of Haitians who fled to Latin America has drastically increased. And right now, this is the process that they're in, sort of fleeing up northward through the continent and through Central America.
So it's a really interesting drama within the drama. You have internally in Haiti, you know, there's chaos now. The prime minister has resigned. It is not outside the realm of possibility that the president would also resign. The Haitians, however, are insisting that the corrupt administration that they've been living with for quite some time come to an end, and they are intent on seeing that through. Meanwhile, you have Haitians outside of Haiti who are experiencing their own hell, trying to work their way up north through the spine of Central and South America to find a way to come back home or to go somewhere else where they can settle and resume something of an orderly life. But they are experiencing great trouble as well. Well, thanks so much, Kim, for your update today. And we will certainly continue to rely on you for developments inside of Haiti or related to Haiti in the near future. Thanks again for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Trace, and we'll hopefully talk again soon.
Thank you. We'll take a little break and come back to the next half of our program right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. I began the program today by telling you I'm having a little technical drama of my own. My computer refuses, or had refused, still is refusing to load up my program. And it's taking forever to configure the programs that I typically use to connect with you, but we are proceeding just the same. I'll figure it all out and see where we go from here. But I wanted to talk about, in the second half of the program, what is being touted as the Great Summit Meeting today. Here's how I see it so far. We have two guys, Russia's Vladimir Putin and USA's Donald Trump, meeting today at the Presidential Palace in Helsinki, Finland. Their seconds, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, meeting separately also at the palace. They'll talk. We don't know what's on the agendas, the specifics on their respective agendas. And then there'll be lunch, and then there'll be a news conference, and then everybody goes home. And they would have, at the end of the day, achieved something that we have never seen in the world of diplomacy. The superpowers would have conducted their own version of a summit meeting. And this is happening in the backdrop of, against the backdrop, I should say, of a number of unusual things. For one thing, at least from the U.S. point of view, it has not been the history of in the United States that a head of state, a president, would elect on his own to undertake a kind of a separate, closed meeting and in behalf of the country, conduct business that way. We don't know what they're talking about. We don't know whether he's prepared to talk about anything sensitive at this time. But we see on the other side of the coin, we see Vladimir Putin, who, on the other hand, has been extremely experienced in matters of diplomacy and in matters of, handling sensitive areas for his government, and then coming into the fullness of leadership for the Soviet Union, which transitioned into being Russia. We don't know what they're talking about. We have no idea. We can conjecture based on international developments, and particularly developments concerning both the United States and Russia. It's pure conjecture as to what they will talk about. But it certainly is a new experience in the minds of Americans and of the world, that we have a president who has decided on this format, this particular format. We don't know what he's talking about. There are no witnesses to this summit. People are not invited to observe what's going on. And we just have to take their word when they have this news conference as to what went on and what the results were. Well, I think that that should concern us. I think that that should concern us greatly, because the two people engaging in this off-limits summit, the two principals, Putin and Trump, are known to be people who cannot be trusted and who have had long histories in doing under-the-table things that warrant constant supervision and constant oversight. And in any event, it is most unusual that a president would say this is the way it's going to be. It indicates also that the president has decided, in fact, he is the leader of the United States. Nobody else needs to know what it is he's doing. He has the power and authority to do these things. And so he is assuming the power and authority he believes are vested in him. He's not doing anything clandestine. He's just doing something unusual. And the people of the United States will simply have to trust and trust in the middle of all that Donald Trump has represented, and a lot of it has to do with a compulsive propensity to lie and distort the truth, and certainly to proceed with a personal agenda that he makes appear to be the public agenda, the country's agenda. So with that in mind, we can't trust this process. We just can't trust this process. But it says very clearly, and we have to recognize that this is a kind of breaking point for many things. It confirms the impotence or the unwillingness of the political power structure as a whole to have any meaningful influence in matters of state. It is outrageous, I think, that a president would be permitted. I mean, people are talking and whatnot, but they're being very polite. This happens to be a major shift, not just in the way things are done, but it's a major shift in our internal politics. It has been up until this point that people expect a cooperative process. They expect the president to report to Congress, to report to the people, and Trump just says, I'm not going through that. It is, to me, a meaningless exercise, although it happens to be part of the constitutional mandate between the president and the systems of control that represent the power of the people. He has dispensed with that. And as of this day, I think it is fair to say that he has taken the country another level into the realm of an autocracy. He doesn't have to talk to anybody. And he decides what's important. He alone decides what's important. And the country will have to accept whatever it is he does. So with this meeting today, we have the neutralization, the efficient the president has efficiently altered the relationship that we popularly believe to be constitutional, the relationship of authority and how the country, at least the perception of how the country should run as a cooperative exercise between Congress and the president. As of this day, the president has made it absolutely clear that he is in charge. He will do whatever he wants to do. And the Congress is just sitting there saying, please don't do it. And it is really mind-boggling how one fell swoop, Donald Trump has converted Congress into a spineless, echoing chamber of individuals who, it seems, at least this is their thinking, because this is how they're acting, that they have neither the will or the desire to do their jobs. And we know from experience, and it's an ongoing process with this president, that he cannot be trusted. Donald Trump has agendas we know nothing about. And imagine that in the middle of a huge imbroglio over the conduct of the presidency in the face of, you know, supposed oversight that is not at all effective, he has said he has silenced Congress. He has cut them out of the loop. And by that I mean he has cut the people out of any meaningful impact on how this country is run. He has become, as of this day, he has become his own government. We just happen to inconveniently be around. We have no say. We have no power to control things. We don't know what they're doing. And he has made it acceptable. The idea of cutting the people out, cutting them off, going around them, and having his way. And we know that his way is a very dangerous way. It is an autocrat's way. It's the way in which you have a person of whom we have had many, many doubts as to his mental acuity. But he's very, very clear about his interests, his personal interests, the interests of his family and close friends. And I am not at all surprised And I would not be at all surprised if in this closed summit session, we have a number of deals being cut that ordinarily in the light of day would be found to be unacceptable. But we have the newspapers, they're accepting this arrangement from Donald Trump. They're accepting the idea that Trump, basically, we have to just trust him. That is not how the country works. That is not how it's supposed to work. We should have some kind of input here. We should have some kind of influence over the actions of the president. We should have seen a wholesale rebellion in Congress over this. A president going off on his own. Heaven knows what it is he decides is important to discuss about the country, with another person who has also worried his nationals. As a former KGB operative and decision maker, the issues that he has been involved in and still is involved in, and we have a closed meeting, and people are actually covering this thing as if it is real, as if there's nothing wrong with it, as if it is a legitimate process. You know, I'm not concerned at this point about what Vladimir Putin decides to do. He's an autocrat, and he has not really functioned outside of his definition and the people's acceptance of what his autocracy is all about. What I'm talking about now is President Trump. How is it possible that the President of the United States and his Secretary of State, who has gained no good reputation as a competent representative of the interests of the people of the United States. He's been called a thug, and most recently was described as a person with the habits of a gangster. This is not the language. This is not the tradition, you know, and I'm not standing here as a protector of tradition, but it is a very significant and marked departure from what the perceived conduct ought to be in the matters of foreign policy and even domestic policy. We've been given so many hints of what this president is doing. And along with those hints, we are seeing that the Congress itself has decided to emasculate itself. It decided to give up its power and its authority, which at least theoretically has to do with safeguarding the interests of the people. When you have a president that can say, look, I don't care what you're thinking. I'm the president of the United States, and here's what it means, whether you agree with it or not. It means I'm in charge. Me, personally, I'm in charge. This is my country, and things are going to be done my way. I don't have to account to you. I don't have to come to you and share with you a vision. I don't have to ask for your input. I don't need it. I am the president. And you need to understand, from my perspective, when I tell you that I'm in the president, it means I am totally in charge. You have no hold over me. You have no authority over me. And the fate of the entire nation is in my hands. You're just going to have to deal with that, whether you like it or not. Well, that's a very marked departure from the history of diplomacy, for one thing, but a marked departure from this whole concept of what we consider the word democracy to mean. There's no reason for people today to be worried about what is going on in a room with two world powers unsupervised. They're talking and they're making decisions for the entire world, two of them in a room, whether we agree or not. We don't have any information. So on this day, the president officially has made it clear that he can lock the people out. He doesn't need them around. They're a bother. They're an inconvenience. And they get in the way. They get in the way of his personal agenda. What have we seen of his personal agenda so far is that what concerns him first is his ego, but he has a plan. And his plan is that now he has access to all of the goodies. He really does. It's his personal possession. The country is his personal property. Might as well just put a big sign up saying Trump on the entire country. We are just inconveniently living here, calling ourselves Americans. But he is the only American, the only true American, because he has the power to get done whatever he envisions. And we've seen how frightening his visions are. But I look also at the gatekeepers, Congress, how completely ineffective they've decided to be. They've decided to let this president do whatever the heck he wants to do. Oh, yeah, they'll put up a symbolic fight, and they'll talk about process, and they'll talk about, you know, the Constitution and all. But in the end, there is no real resistance from Congress. There's no resistance, really, no effective resistance. And by resistance, I don't just mean people saying no. By resistance, I mean people doing their jobs. We don't see a concerted effort being made in behalf of protecting the country, the people's rights, that are affirmed by the Constitution as to what it is we are entitled to as citizens of this country. This man has been a veritable wrecking ball. He loves it. He enjoys doing it. And if you want any further evidence of it, look at how people, even in Britain, reacted just to his visit. It creates turmoil wherever he goes. We'll pick this discussion up, and hopefully I'll be technically in play by then. Thanks for listening. We'll continue the conversation. Bye-bye. ¶¶